Today, the long slow burn, the DFA Daily to the 17th of August 2020. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour and with a little philosophy on the side. APRA has received early release data submissions for the period ended the 9th of August 2020 from 175 funds, and funds have submitted that information, of course, on a best endeavours basis. And they said that over the week to the 9th of August, 88,000 applications were received by funds, of which 44,000 were initial applications and 44,000 were repeat applications. And this brought the total number of initial applications to 3 million and repeat applications to 1.1 million since the inception of the scheme. Over the week to the 9th of August, superannuation funds made payments to 95,000 members, bringing the total number of payments by funds to their members to 4 million since inception. The total value of payments during the week was 0.71 billion, with 31.1 billion paid since inception. And the average payment made over the period since inception was $7,689 overall and $8,487 when considering repeat applications only. Now, Prime Minister Scott Morrison stated prior to the 2019 election that he would honour proposed legislated increases in the superannuation guarantee scheme due to take effect as from July 2021. However, he noted on the 14th of August that he might consider abandoning that commitment given the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. And his comments came after Reserve Bank Governor Philip Lowe confirmed to a parliamentary committee that it was the RBA's view that increasing the superannuation guarantee could reduce wages and curtail consumption and could impact employment. The Reserve Bank of Australia Governor Philip Lowe said on Friday that lifting the super guarantee from the current 9.5% would reduce wages, cut consumer spending, and could ultimately cost jobs. The evidence is that increases of this form do get offset by lower wage growth over time, Dr. Lowe told a parliamentary hearing on Friday. If this increase goes ahead, I would expect wage growth to be even lower than it would otherwise be. There will be less current income, and if there is less income, there may well be less spending, and if there is less spending, there may be less jobs. Now, asked by the AFR at the weekend about Dr. Lowe's assessment and the government's response to the Retirement Income Review, Morrison said that there had been a rather significant event since the 2019 election when the coalition pledged not to alter the legislated super rise. They are matters we are aware of, and they have to be considered in the balance of all the other things that the government has been doing in this space, he said. And the Prime Minister is aware that if the government seeks to abandon or defer the super rise, it would face an uphill battle in the Senate and a revolt from the powerful $3 trillion superannuation industry at the next election. Now, Jane Hume, the responsible minister, said on RN this morning that she was agnostic to the proposed change, while Labour went into bat accusing the Morrison government of dismantling the superannuation system. But 2 points. First, the world has indeed changed as COVID bites, and income growth is stalling for those fortunate enough even to be in work. Second, continuing to pour money into a broken superannuation system when rates are so low makes little sense. There is, of course, a major review report on superannuation sitting with the government, which is more than 600 pages long. And here and now, around 600,000 people have already withdrawn their balances to support lifestyle spending, according to the latest Avalbeta report. And this just gets worse. The main beneficiaries from raising the superannuation guarantee to 12% are funds, which gain from earning fatter management fees at the expense of both workers and taxpayers. Talking of failed policies, The Guardian reported today that fewer than 250 people have applied for the Morrison government's home builder scheme, despite the hype from an industry association that said it was the most effective stimulus in decades. The federal government announced the $688 million scheme just over 2 months ago, offering homeowners up to $25,000 to either build a new home or renovate an existing one in a bid to prop up demand in Australia's construction sector during the coronavirus-induced economic crisis. But the government opted against passing new legislation to deliver the scheme, meaning it is relying on agreements with individual states and territories to provide the grants. Appearing before the Senate's COVID-19 Select Committee on Friday, Treasury officials revealed that the government was only aware of 247 formal applications so far. These included 157 in South Australia and 90 in Tasmania. They are the applications that have been received to date, Vicky Wilson, the head of Treasury's Social Policy Division, told the committee. To date, no payments have been made. The government has previously predicted that the scheme would support about 20,000 new builds and 7,000 substantial renovations, and has previously said tens of thousands of people had registered their interest, but these are not formal applications. Officials on Friday played down the sluggish start to the programme, saying the majority of states and territories had only begun accepting applications throughout the course of July, whereas New South Wales and Victoria had started to do so in just the past week. Yet, as I reported last week, the HIA were trumpeting its success. Something just does not add up. And yet again, the industry is calling for even more government support to help the construction sector. Is there no end? Now, the RBA Governor Lowe's outing on Friday in front of the House of Representatives Standing Committee on Economics was certainly interesting. Now, it was low on rhetoric, and his dominant theme is the need to support the economy through job creation, such that every policy should be assessed through its capacity to boost jobs. And he also said that by borrowing today to support the economy, we're avoiding an even bigger loss of output and jobs that would damage our economy and society for years to come, which will put ongoing strain on the budget, especially when financing costs had never been lower. And he honed in on structural reforms in areas such as industrial relations, lifting skills, promoting innovation, addressing overregulation and taxation, and focused in on the issue of state stamp duty. He contrasted federal support at $314 billion with state support at $44 billion and said that the states had considerable influence on job creation, particularly in the infrastructure space, and should be focused on that objective rather than protecting a credit rating. And under questioning about the bank's current forecast, which envisages the inflation rate still to be at 1.5%, having dipped down to 1% by the end of the forecast horizon, that's December 2022, and the unemployment rate to be at 7%, both way off the RBA's central objectives, the governor pointed out that the board could reduce the cash rate by 0.1% to 0.2%, but he doubted whether that would make any worthwhile difference. Another possibility was to move the bond rate target out along the curve from the current 3 years to 5 years. And he pointed out that the decision to target the rate, Japan is the only other country exercising yield curve control, was based on two considerations. It is a more direct way of achieving a low funding cost. Targeting the volume of bond purchases would also have lowered the rate, but it'd have come with the difficulties of calibrating the volume to achieve the required rate. And it reinforces forward guidance. The government is entirely confident that the cash rate will not be increased for 3 years, given the requirements for the board to be confident that the inflation would be sustainably within the 2 to 3% band. Now, their ability to forecast, of course, is just laughable. And he said he could not be confident that the cash rate would remain unchanged for 5 years, making the extension of the target to a 5-year maturity unhelpful from a forward guidance perspective. Most likely, the bank is expecting to raise or abandon the target for the 3-year rate sometime in 2022. And he was asked about negative interest rates. He recognised that the major benefit would be on the exchange rate, but he argued that the costs would outweigh those benefits. He highlighted the costs in terms of the credit creation mechanism, pointing out that European banks' lending had been impacted Issues around bank profitability through negative returns on exchange rate settlement balances can be managed through a threshold system, but the big issue seems to be around negative retail rates. And he noted that if the deposit rate was negative, people would save more rather than spend on the basis that expected income growth would be negative. The net stimulus argument supporting rate cuts seems to be contradicted when rates go negative. He observed that those countries with negative rates had not gone more negative in the COVID period, nor has any central bank gone from positive to negative. If the global recovery expected post-COVID disappoints, then more pressure might come on the central banks, including the RBA, to be more aggressive in their policy options. Now, Bill Evans at Westpac makes the point that in Australia's banking system, retail deposits only represents around 60% of assets, generally compared to nearly 100% in Asian, Japanese and European banking systems. So it might be possible for Australian banks to avoid negative retail deposit rates and mortgage rates, confining negative rates to the wholesale market. But that is, in my view, a big gamble. The longer negative rates roll on, the more likely it is that retail depositors and even mortgage rates could go negative. That's a slippery slope that I don't think we want to go near. And finally, Bendigo and Adelaide Bank today released their financial year 20 results. They deferred any dividend payment compared with 31 cents in the first half, with financial year 20 statutory net profit down 48.8% compared with last year, $292.8 million. A rise of cost of income of 350 basis points to 62.7%, a fall of 3 basis points in net interest margin, and a fall of 29.8% in cash earnings per share. They expect the net interest margin in the financial year 21 to be down another 7 basis points, and the cash profit at the bank fell 27.4% to $301.7 million for the year, as the bank maintained its COVID-19 provisions made at the first half of $127.7 million. And of course, that weighed heavily on the result. The cash earnings number was 7% lower the consensus estimates, and Bendigo Bank shares were sold off sharply at the open, falling 4.9% on the bell. As at the 31st of July, a total of 24,365 customers have received 3 to 6 month payment deferrals, with 4,041 accounts having recommenced repayments. 20,324 customer accounts remain actively in deferrals, representing about $4.6 billion of residential and consumer loans, or 9% of the portfolio, and $2 billion of commercial loans, representing around 12% of that portfolio. Their HomeSafe portfolio valuations have changed, with a growth outlook revised to down 4% in the first year, up 3% in the second year, and up 4% in year three, with 61% in Melbourne and 39% in Sydney. Property values would need to fall by a further 38%, they said, before any impact on regulatory capital was seen. So overall, as with many regional banks, they are under pressure to try to meet the big four on mortgage sales while not getting economic scale benefits. Bendigo continues to target a CET1 range of between 9 and 9.5% and came in at 9.25%, which it said it will review following the finalisation by APRA of the new capital adequacy framework. Meanwhile, although internal stress tests show that Bendigo maintained its capital ratios above the regulatory minimum, it decided to defer its final dividend given the current economic uncertainty. So this is more evidence of the long, slow burn as financial services companies try to come to terms with all of the deteriorating portfolio parameters. We're still seeing rising defaults and delinquencies. We're seeing more households struggling to make repayments despite all the government support. And of course, later in the year, that government support also disappears. So I think being a regional bank at the moment is a pretty tall order, but frankly, being a mainstream bank isn't much better. Before I go, a quick reminder, tomorrow We'll be running our next live stream at 8 p.m. Sydney time, and we'll be discussing the Financial Confidence Index data, which we've just finished analysing. And there are some important messages in there too. So I look forward to seeing you tomorrow live. Or if you want to ask a question beforehand, do send it through to the DFA blog. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.